far away from my friend and relation, betrayed by the black velvet band.
In the Shropshire Hills, there is a road to the village of Ratchup, where, it's said, a funeral procession still passes, long after the mourners themselves are gone. It comes at dusk, a stately black carriage drawn by four horses in full mourning dress, moving slowly through the village. The coffin is, as always, the same, gleaming, silent, precise. Behind it walk a retinue of mourners, well-dressed, solemn, heads bowed, their faces obscured, their pace never falters. No voice, no breath, no flicker of life among them, only the creak of the harness, the clatter of hooves, and the gleam of lantern light on the road. Those who see it do not forget. It is no illusion, no half-sighting in fog. It passes full-measured, deliberate, a funeral of another time. Not a warning, nor merely a tale to frighten, but a funeral procession, bound on road, forever carried by shadows of the past. Welcome to the Shropshire Witches. I'm Alex.
And I'm Amy.
And today, if that little write-up didn't give it away, we're talking about funerals and funeral rites and various customs and a couple of little stories for you. So we hope you'll enjoy this. I'm very excited. This was Amy's pitch, and I was thrilled when she suggested it. We're going to delve headfirst into the rituals and the rites surrounding death. So what I'm going to do without further delay is pass over to the Queen of Death, and I say that with love. I'm going to pass to Amy, because you are the doyenne, the chatelaine of the Kingdom of Death. Amy, why don't you start us off and tell us where we're going to go with this?
I just want to add briefly that I am the Queen of Death and not the Angel of Death. It's never been proven.
We should have made that clear.
Those it's never been rumors. Proven. All allegations are allegations, and that's that.
Yes, I agree.
So I'm really excited for this one because there's so many places we could go with this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think perhaps the best place to start is in the Victorian period.
Oh, yeah, of
because
course.
Because to me, there's no time more synonymous with death, with funerals. And it's really the period, I think, at least, that funeral customs and funeral, all the trappings of funerals that we now know become prominent and become a real feature in society. So today's episode, we're going to delve into that. As Alex said, we're going to look at some stories. We're going to look at some funeral folklore, both inside and outside of the county of Shropshire. And also, we're going to look at a little bit about the history of funerals. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, this probably isn't going to be a absolute, you know, decisive account of it because it's such a vast topic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But what we will probably be doing at some point is returning to this topic and exploring it more because it's so vast and exciting.
It's going to be a two-parter, isn't it? I think we've done this before. We've kind of established when we started talking, we thought this is definitely going to end up being as long as the Doomsday Book. So we decided, right, it's going to be a two-parter because it's such a, like you say, we're starting the Victorians. They are the sort of the bastion of this sort of thing. As you know, when we had John O'Namara, one of my favourite episodes, he was the kind of the king of the Victorian macabre graveyards. You know, it's a toe in the water. I mean, his knowledge is superb. And I think it's, we sort of dip our toe in and we kind of think, gosh, you know, it's so vast. Where does one start? You could do a whole series just on Victorian funeral rites and rituals and probably still not kind of get to right to the core of it. So it's a hugely interesting subject. Go on, kick us off. I'm excited. Back to you. I'm going to stop kind of digressing.
So shall we start with a little bit of funeral folklore?
I think
that's a good place to start. So funeral folklore usually involves discussions about a specific way in order to respect the dead, in order to carry out the funeral, in order for that person to pass on. And the concept of a good death isn't new to folklore or to history. It's been something that people have wanted to give their loved ones for as long as we've, you know, had that concept. But it really becomes a preoccupation in the Victorian period. So you get this wealth of folklore that kind of concerns the every stage of the grieving process and every stage of the funeral process,
Yeah.
all the way through to the afterlife. So you get certain things like as soon as somebody has died, you have to open up all the windows to ensure that the spirit can leave the house.
For the soul, yeah.
And that's a very prominent one that's found kind of cross-culturally.
Mm.
You get things like you have to rearrange the room that the person died in. So if the spirit does return, they might come into the room that they passed in and find it confusing, so they won't linger. And that's what's led a lot of folklorists to suggest that a lot of funeral practices or funeral folklore is actually to try and prevent the house from gaining a ghost. And you see that as well with things like in Shropshire, there was a traditional custom, and probably elsewhere, to be honest, where the corpse had to be watched from death to the funeral overnight, and candles were lit and placed around the deceased person, and a small plate of salt was placed on the chest, which was meant to not only have a practical thing of preventing swelling, but also to ward away spirits, because salt is seen as a real purifying kind of thing. It's seen as something that can protect from evil spirits. And as I said, you get kind of folklore that starts from the advent of death all the way through to after the funeral, really. So you get a very, very famous cross-cultural one of telling the bees. And it's the idea that the morning of the person's death, or in some cases, in some areas, in Shropshire, it was this, in the morning of the funeral, that you had to go outside and tell the hive of bees, the family of bees, I nearly said, but they are, I suppose.
They are a family, yeah.
They are, and they're part of your family.
Yes.
You have to go and tell the bees of the passing of the person in the household. And that was a sign of respect. You also, in some parts of Shropshire, particularly South Shropshire, you told the rooks as well, because the rooks were seen as quite pious birds. So they would show the correct amount of respect to the deceased person. And you get all sorts of reports, again, all across Britain, of this practice happening in the kind of 18th and 19th centuries. And also what happens if you don't show respect to the bees and you don't tell the bees. So there's quite a number of references where someone hasn't done the ritual, they haven't gone and told the bees, and the bees have fled the hive and left, or they've died in some circumstances. So it was really seen as a very important thing to do. And also you get some really lovely anecdotes from Shropshire, where there's one in particular, Sam Rogers. And Sam Rogers was a beekeeper, and he passed away. And it said that, and this was reported in newspapers, I had a brief chat with kind of his granddaughter, and she recalls it being a family story as well, is that on the morning of his funeral, about 14 hives worth of bees all flocked around his gravestone. And it's really bizarre, because in the newspaper reports, they actually speak to a bee expert. I can't remember what they're called. And the bee expert says that at the time of the funeral, it wouldn't be the sort of behavior they do, because they tend to be quite sleepy and quite kind of drowsy at that time. And other people have said perhaps it was the flowers, because so many people had put the flowers on the grave, perhaps that had brought the bees. But certainly it's a curious thing that's very linked to this custom of telling the bees. And also there was, I think it was in 1994, and a episode in Ludlow where the same thing happened. They told the bees of the passing of the beekeeper, and the hives had kind of flocked on the corner near the church to, in the folklore, it means show respect to the person who'd gone.
Yeah.
So I think they're really good examples of certain things you must do. There's also things, again, across cultural, where you should, if you're part of a funeral party, the funeral should travel down an unfamiliar road to stop the spirit from returning home. And it was extra useful if that road had a crossroads, or it was a really difficult thing, like road to travel. And that's where you get things like corpse roads coming in, which I know you're a bit of an expert on corpse roads.
Obsessed.
So I'm going to pass you on to pass the baton on in the relay and let you just have a little, tell us what a corpse road is, Alex.
I love that. And thank you for approaching that in the gentle way that you did, because I am obsessed, as anyone who follows my TikTok or Instagram will know, or indeed anyone who sat next to me at a supper party. It's never too tenuous, let me tell you. But nothing brings the boys to the yard like a corpse road.
Forget milkshakes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just talk about the corpse roads, babe. Talk about cadavers. So going around the houses, as always. So corpse roads are this fascinating thing, and they still exist in the sense of marking the landscape, but well, arguably are still used, but now today as footpaths and sheep paths and bridleways. These were paths that led remote houses and remote communities to the nearest church or chapel. And you would have chapel of ease, and there's one very near to me, just on the Welsh border here. And you would have other chapels where, you know, you wouldn't be able to bury them as such, but you could have a sort of religious, a kind of a pit stop. But a lot of these, so the most famous, and we started with the Ratchet funeral procession, one of the most famous in Shropshire is the Long Mynd leading to and from Ratchet. There is a corpse road there, which is still very much walkable and runnable. I've done it. And these were routes that would traverse the landscape whereby people would carry the coffins, the body, and you can find lich stones. Okay, so from the Anglo-Saxon for a corpse, in essence, basically, or they would rest these coffins on these specific stones which had been blessed, because if they touched the ground, they believed that they were tying the soul to the ground, and that spot would then be haunted. So it had to have specific stops where you could rest, which was folkloric and practical, because if you're carrying a coffin across Long Mynd or Dartmoor or wherever it may be, you'll know about it. And they would carry it across, and there'd be various paths which you touched on, Amy. So you would have, generally they would travel in straight lines, and then there would have to be a bend or something to confuse the soul. They'd have to leave the house feet first so they couldn't return. They'd have to cross a body of water. There was all these things that were superstitions that they believed would prevent the soul from returning to their to the place of their passing, most commonly their home. And then they would end up at the church or the chapel, and they would rest in a lich gate, as I've already explained the word lich. So these lich stones, this lich gate, and they would rest in these, and lots of lich gates. There are some very old ones. A lot were restored in the 19th century. But for those that don't know, they are those wonderful sort of porches, basically. You'll see a church and a path, and then this wonderful little porch at the entrance to the church. That's a lich gate. And there's a wonderful one at Stokesay, actually, with an old mounting block for horses as well. It's wonderful. And you would put the coffin inside there. Again, practical and folkloric, because it would protect it from the elements. But also the old belief was that the soul, and I think we've touched on this before, the soul of the person who had passed last, that had been buried, would stand as a sentinel over the graveyard.
Yes.
And the next person who'd been brought in would then replace them upon burial, but they would leave them there in the lich gate. So these paths are tied to lich gates, but they're fascinating routes that a lot of the time people have walked. And I think I did a video actually on TikTok, and there was quite a lot of people were writing and saying, I think there's one near me. And they'd have all sorts of things where some, you know, old stories would go that a horse would shy or whinny or something on a route where they said that past trauma had been known. They are, and Amy, you can attest this, they are actually, once you realise, and there's one by me that Amy's going to come over this summer, and we're going to go and walk it, but they're quite visible and quite obvious.
Yes,
you
they
know
are.
What they are, aren't they? Yeah, you can go, this is a corpse road. So I would say to anyone who's listening to this, have a little look. Sometimes if you sort of, even a perfunctory Google search can find some in your area, particularly places like Devon, but they are around, and a lot of the time they predate footpaths and things, but they are, or have since been claimed as footpaths, bridleways, things like that. But generally, if they travel in a pretty straight line, if they're leading towards a church, if they pass a body of water, you can almost guarantee that that would have been, if not part of, an old corpse route. But they are fascinating, and they are, continue to be something I am utterly obsessed with, truly.
It's fascinating. I think it's so evocative of that agrarian life and agrarian kind of landscapes as well. Yeah. They're so cut into the landscapes that, unless you, like you said, unless you knew what they were, you would just think that it's a passage that someone had used for a very long time. And it's interesting because it's interesting for several reasons. The idea of you having to have those places that you stop is very linked to funeral folklore in certain, again, probably elsewhere, but in certain parts of Shropshire that are more built up and more kind of like towns and bigger villages. So it was thought that on the day of the funeral, it was respectful to the dead person, but also to the people who were carrying the coffin, to bring out your kitchen tables or any tables that you had,
yeah,
and lay them in front of your house with white cloth over them.
Yeah.
So you, some people would even give out food or refreshments. There was a cake that was made, which was very, very similar to the ones that are souling cakes that were given out at All Souls Day.
Yeah.
And it was said that as you did the final jag from kind of the entrance to the village into the churchyard, you should put down the coffin at least one of the houses, every couple of houses, and have a moment, reflect on the person, have a drink, probably beer,
Yeah.
and let's face
Get
it,
arsehole carrying a coffee.
Yeah, and then get, you know, to ease your burdens and have that moment of rest and contemplation. And it's also interesting with the corpse roads, that idea of trying to confuse the spirit,
Yeah.
because you see so much of that across the country, even in more kind of industrialized areas. So there's the best example I can think of is Madeley St. Michael's Church. And there's a bit of folklore that says that a wedding shouldn't come into the church the same way a funeral should come in. So traditionally, churches would have two entrances into the church grounds. And this really comes into play about the 1700s with the advent of industry. And I think there's a lot of a link to kind of miasma and disease and the idea of the dead carrying disease.
Yeah.
So you would have a wedding entrance, which would be traditionally on the right, but not always the case. And then you would have a funeral entrance that would be on the left. And as I said, the best example is St. Michael's Church, where there is a very, very clear kind of double entrance and kind of all fork into the entrance of the church itself. And interestingly as well, I'm probably just law dumping on St. Michael's Church now because it was my local church, but in between the two forks was actually a cholera pit, because cholera hit Madeley Wood and Iron Bridge particularly hard in 1836. And they had to have kind of communal burials. We'll talk about communal burials in a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's a big hump in the kind of between the two forks to get to the church. And that's the cholera pit in Madeley, where many cholera victims actually were buried communally. And it's interesting when you look at these kind of folkloric ideas, because there's a practical reason. Have a rest. Folklore says you have to have a rest, but it's to make sure you don't drop the coffin or do anything embarrassing. And, you know, an entrance for a funeral and a wedding, you know, it's in bad taste kind of thing. So there's often very, very practical reasons that people do these things. And also it links to life being a journey. I think there's one entrance in and one entrance out. You would never have a christening in the same day or a wedding on the same day that you had a fresh grave dug, because it was the idea that the grave would claim another victim. So if you were going to bury someone, you had to bury them. You didn't really dig the grave until that burial was due, because it was seen as very bad luck. And yeah, I find these kind of folkloric ideas fascinating. I want to just briefly mention some offerings that were given to graves, because I think often, particularly with the Victorian times, you don't think of grave offerings. When you think of that, you tend to think of like Egypt or something ancient, but it was a common practice, and still is a common practice, to bury the dead with either an offering or with something that links them to their life. So in Shropshire, just like in many, many areas, it was quite common to carry rosemary. So you would carry rosemary as part of the funeral procession. And then when the priest was doing the last rites and finishing the ceremony, you would throw the rosemary into the grave. And that was meant to be seen as a sign of friendship, of loyalty and dedication to that person who'd passed.
Yeah.
as well as that, you see a lot, particularly in the Welsh borders and also probably elsewhere, but into Shropshire, Herefordshire, and places like that, you see a lot of people being buried with something that marks their profession. So the most famous examples are shepherds being buried with a little bit of wool as part of a reminder of, and that's linked to kind of biblical imagery as well, but quite a lot of coal miners were actually buried with pieces of coal in their graves or in their actual coffin as a reminder or as a marker of their role in society. And you get other things as well, very sentimental things. But I just think it's fascinating the idea of someone's profession marking them in the afterlife as well. And you see some amazing gravestones as well. There's a really brilliant one in East Hope Church that actually has an anvil on it because the guy who's buried there was the village blacksmith and from a very long line of village blacksmiths. So it's interesting because I think nowadays we don't tend to focus on how the profession marks the person. It's more their interests, their hobbies, things they liked that becomes part of the funeral service or the memorial. Whereas in the Victorian times, it was quite prominent, even places like Northumbria and stuff to use the profession as a marker of that person. So I just think it's really interesting.
I think it's fascinating. And I think, look, another thing that's fascinating about this sort of thing is the kind of the thing is that a lot of these rites and sort of rituals and things also have been some have been long forgotten, or many have, and others are assumed as well. So, you know, in terms of, like, if you look at things like, if we're looking at churches and things, and we think we're looking at christenings and sort of the opposite of death, really, but the Devil's Door, for example. So this is quite cool, and I'm kind of always very pro this story, because I find it fascinating, this idea that they would leave on the north side, which is the sort of unchristian, the unholy side, as it were, because the priest door is usually on the south side, which was basically, the priest door was just a quick way for him to get into the chancel without having to bump into everyone, really, and to separate as the sort of us and them. But the Devil's Door is this idea of this door that was left open during christenings and the like, funerals as well, for the devil to, you know, to usher him out. The thing is, it's far more likely actually that it was a pre-Reformation thing, as part of, you know, Palm Sunday, things like this, these kind of processions that would take place going straight through the church. And so you would have to have a door to go through and exit through, which would be the north door. And when the Reformation happened, those doors, those processions, those sort of practices, the liturgy altered and they became obsolete, and so the door would be blocked up. But it's less romantic than the idea of the Devil's Door. And what is fascinating, and I think funerals are no exception to this, how some things, even if they weren't necessarily practiced originally, possibly became practiced through rumor, through folklore, through conjecture, all these things that we're like, that's what this means. Because in every age, we put our interpretation on it and go, that's what this is, even if
Oh
it's
gosh,
misericords to whatever. You know, when people look at grotesques and things like this, and they're like, why? Why was it so detailed at the top? Well, they believe that God saw all. And as these things sort of faded with time, you know, we start saying, well, they're apotropaic, or they're this, or they're that, or whatever. Even like Sheila Nigg, and we'll talk about her in another
We
episode.
will be.
But, oh, because Amy loves a Sheila, as we all do. But,
I've got
you
one on
know,
my wall in my living room.
I need to get one. And look, my birthday's
Christmas is
coming up.
coming. Oh, my
Christmas
birthday's
is coming.
before.
Yes, it is. Exactly. And I should be 30 from the wrong direction, very much 30 from the wrong direction, about 8 years in the wrong direction. But a Sheila Nigg, you know, these kind of ideas actually probably either everyone's always obsessed that everything's pagan, and oftentimes they're not. Green Man, will dispel that in another episode as well. Look at me, absolute killjoy. So I'm like, hey,
Angel of Death and Killjoy.
angel and death and killjoy, want to date us? Come on, guys, let's have a menage a trois. But we're great for a pub quiz, if it's a very niche pub quiz.
Very niche.
Very, very niche. But they have these ideas of things that we, and I think it's, we slightly punish ourselves and say it's a very modern thing that we project and say, oh, this is pagan or that's, they've always done it. They've
Oh
always,
God,
it's
yeah.
a very human essence to put a romantic slant on things. And the king and queen of that are the Victorians who love
Oh,
this
yes.
is their neo-Gothic. Everything was a medieval archetype, wasn't it? Or a trope or
Yeah.
something like this is what they did. And a lot of the times they were doing things because it was practical, it was part of the liturgy. But funerals must be one of the most kind of or like sort of ornate things. I find them fascinating. And likewise, the same with, Queen Victoria bringing in the white wedding dress. They brought in all these practices that, and some are like long-standing and are folkloric, but there's also a lot that are slightly more modern interpretations that we're going, that's what this is. And we're like, are we sure?
Yeah, are we sure? And it's so hard to quantify folk belief, isn't it? It's like, and when you look at the Victorian sources for folk belief, they are so vague. It's some colliers, some farmers. One man down the pub told me, and
But
you know,
that's
you.
folklore as well, isn't
It's
it?
folklore and it's fluid, and we find our own interpretation and we naturally gravitate to different things and different ideas, and it ebbs and flows. And I think if, you know, certain things weren't as prolific, but we now remember them, it's not necessarily a bad thing because we do, like you said, put our own slant on everything. And I think the Victor you are right in saying the Victorians were the king and queens of this is medieval, this is ancient, this is Celtic, that kind of thing. And we're doing the same thing, like our generation do the same thing. And I think it's a very human thing to do. And I think it's very human to find meaning in these practices because, you know, there was a time in our evolution where we didn't bury our dead. We didn't have these rituals and we didn't ritualize death or kind of sanctify death. So, really, that evolution to be the place where the Victorians were is fascinating. And I think it's really interesting when you think about the Victorians and their lasting impact on kind of funeral practices. A lot of kind of things that we now take for granted with the funeral industry was a Victorian invention, like the certain advances in coffins, like the ability to have a coffin that doesn't let air in. That was a Victorian invention that was patented in kind of around Birmingham in the middle of the Victorian period. And a lot of kind of that really extra Victorian drip of the silver coffin hangings and the plates and the sort of stuff you see at Bliss Hill in the coffin works is a
Oh, I love
Victorian
that. Yeah.
invention. Interestingly, Birmingham was actually the center for a long time from about first wave was in the 1779, 1780, I believe. But then from about 1865, Birmingham became the center of a lot of the coffin works and coffin
Oh, that's
industries.
interesting.
Yeah. So everywhere would have their local kind of undertakers and they'd have someone who made the coffin. So, for example, in Iron Bridge, it was on Bower Yard, which is the opposite side of the bridge. That's where they had the coffin works. But the actual trappings of the funeral, the ornate carvings, the plaques, that would have come from, in all likelihood, Birmingham. Also, places like Sheffield got in on the act as well. And it's interesting to think about the funeral as a business, as well as the funeral as a human ritual, because it was a very, very kind of economic activity as well. And, you know, funeral undertakers had a very kind of varying reputation throughout the Victorian period. You had some people seeing them as purveyors of God's work and doing the righteous thing, but certainly they were also seen as being kind of the arbiters of falseness, men who traded in kind of deception and lies.
Like Mr. Sourbear, of course, from Oliver Twist.
There's a
Played
quote.
brilliantly by Leonard Rostow, I must say.
I've not seen that.
Oh, you've not seen the 90, is it 1968? The musical, Oliver, with Oliver Reed.
No.
Oh,
It's
I envy you because you are in.
Christmas is coming.
Oh, and the goose is getting fat. That's a game changer. You're going to be obsessed. So good. You are welcome. In advance, you are welcome.
I'm looking forward to it. That'll be very good.
I love the play. Yeah, looking forward to it. I've got to
So.
say as well, just while the theme is there, Amy and I were talking about the Mitfords before this started. This is relevant. Nothing. See, this is the frustrating thing about the Mitfords. Whilst there was a lot about them not to like, they do seem to be never too tenuous, weirdly. But Jessica Mitford, or Decca, and they called her the Red Sheep. She was the communist. She wrote a book called The American Way of Death. This is niche, but Amy can attest.
We love niche on the Shropshire
Witches
podcast.
Okay, so like we've got a very obscure pub quiz coming our way. But The American Way of Death, and interestingly enough, because she basically called out the fact that a lot of undertakers and things were overcharging, making funerals inaccessible because the prices, that sort of thing. So the fact that she did that made quite a wave in terms of Americans being offered cheaper funerals. And in fact, even JFK's funeral, the way that was handled, was influenced by Mitford's book.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's cool.
It's very cool, isn't it? So sorry, I know that's not the Victorian era, but I still think that's quite an interesting thing. She called out the undertakers for being hugely overpriced, and it sort of gave way to a more accessible approach to affordability in funerals. So
yeah,
it's interesting.
It's interesting because that's a very long-standing criticism, because the quote I've got from 1747, so again, not the Victorian period, but it shows the continuity of the criticism of undertakers, is that in the 1700s, they were criticizing them. In the kind of 20th century, they were being criticized. And it just says, the undertaker's business is to watch death and furnish out the funeral with as much pomp and feigned sorrow as heirs or successors of deceased choose to purchase. And it's the idea that actually they don't care.
Yeah.
And that trade in death was seen as being, you know, they have to pretend to care about something that is arguably the hardest part of a person's life, is that transition. And they certainly were seen, and you get all sorts of kind of penny dreadful stories and sort of body snatching, and
we love a penny dreadful,
we do, and unscrupulous kind of funeral directors and grave diggers that are digging one body out as soon as it's been put in to put another in. And these kind of fears were very much in the Victorian mindset of that passage through to death, because it often wasn't the same as how the funerals work now and burial works now. You often didn't have that plot for very long, and that's, I know we covered that in quite a bit of detail in the Jono episode, but
yeah,
funerals are a very Victorian thing. Cemeteries are a very Victorian phenomena in the way that we understand them now. Obviously, there's always been burial grounds and things, but the cemetery is the kind of grand sprawling place like you get in London or Liverpool or Paris. It's a very Victorian phenomena. And I think there's also an idea of Victorian funerals being that grandiose, big public displays of grief, but then the certain rules about grief. But I mean, I'd be interested to know your opinion on this, is that do you think the way the Victorians grieved, and I think this is a whole different episode really, but stay with me, the way the Victorians grieved and the spectacle of grief is a very different phenomena to modern day, or even kind of the 20th century, or do you think there's more similarities and differences?
That's such a good question. I think, do you know what? I think the pageantry is arguably not there to the same degree. It is in some cases when you look at the idea of a state funeral and a royal funeral, which are different things. There are, for the layman, for us average folk, I am told that a lot of the time now there's some quick crematorial funerals, and they're sort of like in night jobs, and you know, increasingly I think they're becoming, have more of a secular focus. I've been brought up in the Shropshire Hills, so I still go to some sort of quite old school kind of almost like Baptist funerals, bit of Bread of Heaven, all that kind of stuff. But I think what I think is the contrast here, I think some of the religion and things have gone out of it. I think the pageantry, but I think some of the superstitions and the approach to grief and things are still the same. I think the superstition. Yeah. So I think there are still people, myself included, who open the window when somebody passes away. I think there are people that say the Lord's Prayer. I think there are people that cross themselves. I think there are various things that we do. I think people slow down or stop for a hearse. There are still people, I've seen them do it even in town, take their hat off, things.
Yes, like I was going to say, take the hat off.
Yeah. So I think there are things that are just intrinsic that just happen that have almost really on par with shooting magpies have become human nature. I think the pageantry, you don't see generally now those great big ornate funerals with the horses and all that kind of thing. I still pass regularly, and I drive through Coleham a lot in Shrewsbury. And so I see Pews and Frank Painter's and Son. I see them a lot. There's often a hearse. There's often somebody standing in front of the hearse. They're often got a top hat and things. So it's still going on. But I would argue, does the world stand still the way it did in Victorian times? But then did it? You know, London probably carried on. Our projection of funerals in the Victorian times, they were ornate, but a lot of it we see on films and things like that. So it's like the whole street stood still. So I don't think we have the pageantry to the same degree, but I would argue that our attitudes around death and our superstitions, particularly since COVID, where it became more, we were more acutely aware of it. I think if anything, we've slightly regressed and gone back to some older ways. Regress sounds like it's a bad thing, but I think we're very and continue to be very superstitious around death. I think our attitude to funerals is slightly different. We're maybe a bit more clinical. There's more colourful funerals, celebrations of life, things like that, to each their own. But I think our superstitions around death definitely are still mirroring some of the Victorian attitudes, definitely. But they gave us, just as they gave us some of the Christmas ideas and some of the wedding ideas, they kind of set the blueprint of what a funeral is, and we maybe took out some of the lavishness, especially in a cost of living crisis. But yeah, it's, look, these things are cyclical is my feeling, and what's to say in another 20 years that we're not seeing these big ornate sort of pageantry funerals. Look at Irish funerals, you know. My lovely dad, bless him, passed away not long ago, as you know. And I remember I was messaging a very good friend of mine, an Irish friend of mine, Roger, and he was amazing. And he was saying, you know, I was coming back from the funeral, I was texting, saying all went fine, this kind of thing. And I think he was amazed that I was already on my way back because he was Irish. So he was waiting for this big Irish funeral. And I was saying, well, we had a wake and we went through, you know, a bit of carver, things like this. But the Irish funeral, I mean, that's something to behold, isn't it? So
yes, that's a whole different episode, isn't it? Because that is fascinating.
So differently and culturally amazing. And I look, you'll probably know more about it than I do, but I just remember thinking that he was sort of surprised I'd already made my way back. And I was thinking, it's an English funeral, it's a much more toned down affair. But look, maybe arguably with things like Catholicism, they have open caskets, things like that, maybe they've got more of a peaceable relationship with death. We sanitize ourselves, you have a chapel arrest, but a lot of us don't go there, and then somebody's cremated, buried, whatever, and that's it. You know, it's all it's a funny old affair, isn't it?
It is, it's a funny old thing. And I think I'd be interested as well to know your thoughts on this as well, but do you think, because I'm inclined to think so, that part of the reason we've sanitized death in the 21st century, and we've got a version of it, and even the stories we tell, kind of, you know, I'm a religious studies teacher. Some of the stories that people are told when they are experiencing grief is a very sanitized version of religion or of, you know, the funeral, kind of whole world of funerals.
Yeah.
Do you think it's because death itself is away from the public sphere? So obviously in the Victorian times, there was a lot more public health crises. There was a lot more very, very kind of hard conditions for all, you know, elements of society, because things like cholera, yes, people who were in kind of working class communities, kind of bigger kind of cities and towns would have a predisposition to it, but equally it hit all levels of society. It was called King Cholera for a reason.
Yeah.
Do you think our relationship with death has changed because death itself in society has changed?
Yeah, again, that's a really good question. I think one of the mistakes we make, let's look at Dickens, because always, so in Nickleby, he says, doesn't he, the pain of parting is nothing to the joy of meeting again. I think when you've got, and there are still people like that in a non-secular society, there's that belief that there is something better.
Yes.
Does it make grief any less? I wouldn't say so. You miss somebody, but there is you accept, and they would hope that somebody's going somewhere else. You also previously, before that, obviously you had, and in Catholic societies, you know, paying for prayers and things like this and praying for people's souls, and people still do that. I mean, albeit they probably don't really part with cash, but you light candles. They're all things that we still do. In terms of our sanitized view, I think our fear of death is the same, but in a different way. I think previous ages, you were afraid of death because you could be punished with death. I think then you go into other ages, and the very threat of disease without cure made death extremely fearful. I think in a modern age, I wonder if we're afraid of what we can't control. I'm afraid of the last bastion of what we can't prevent and can't control, much like the weather. I think death is that thing that we
Death is the
just
weather.
exactly. And like you look, they say the road to death can be very painful. Death itself is fairly straightforward. It's the road to death, isn't it? But there are things you can do. There are treatments for diseases, conditions, things like this. But ultimately, we are all organic matter. We will all die. And so I think some people become very accepting of it. I think there is always going to be in society an innate fear of death, because we discuss things like saying, hope I go out like a light, hope I go out at 90, hope I don't lose my mind, hope I don't lose my bladder, whatever it might be. All these things, we're all slightly worried about it. We also all have the folly of youth and that arrogance that when we're young, nothing can touch us. I think we're not exposed to death and decay in the way that we were, so maybe we find ourselves slightly more infallible, and when it does happen, we're mortified by it. But I think that's not to say that our ancestors weren't equally as devastated when they lost children to cruel diseases and things like that. I just think that we have a more sanitized view. I
I
would
think.
in some ways, sorry, yeah, as I said, just always maybe the same acceptance of death, because some people think they protect children by not going to funerals or X, Y, and Z. Whereas I think in some ways, normalizing death for what it is, I think is so vital. As somebody who's, you know, I lost my old dog and my dad in the same year, I was like, oh God, cut me some slack. But the thing is, my dad died at home, surrounded by his family. And Serge died very peacefully as well, you know. So, and my dad would fully have appreciated me comparing him to Serge. Don't worry about that. But I think, yeah, I think we've got a sanitized view, and we're afraid of death because we don't know how it's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to come for us. But also because it is, we're afraid of the inevitable.
And I think you've touched on some really brilliant points there, and I think it was really good you mentioning all of it was really good. It's not me just picking one part I liked.
No, please
But
do.
yeah, everything else, Alex. No.
Ouch.
It was really good you mentioning the fact that our ancestors, and I use the word ancestors liberally, it's the people that came before us.
Yeah.
They had the same fears, they had the same experiences, the same
Definitely.
feelings. And I think one of the things that has always irritated me a little bit, as I won't call myself a historian, but someone who's studied history, is the idea that if you were in the past, you didn't feel, and that we are the only ones with emotion. And in the
A very
past,
common mistake, isn't it? They
yeah,
think
you know, if
weren't
you
fearing
had.
losing our loved ones. Of course they were.
Yeah, and I think that just because they were more exposed to it doesn't take away from the fact that they would have felt, and we do a grave injustice teaching, I think, and sharing history like that, the idea that, oh, well, she had 18 kids and lost seven of them, so she, you know, things like that. It's human, we're human, and I think it was really good you bringing that to light, is that it doesn't matter what century we're in, it doesn't matter whether we're Victorian or Edwardian, or I don't know, Anglo-Saxon, we all would have felt those same pain of loss and that experience, because we all were human. And I think we've really touched on some powerful points there, is that yes, the Victorian period is synonymous with this kind of pageantry and the very complex funeral folklore and
Yeah.
funeral ideas that we've barely scratched the surface with some of it, but that was to alleviate some feelings or to feel in control of the uncontrollable. And there's a really powerful little piece of Shropshire folklore that it always annoys me the way it was actually shared by Charlotte Byrne, because she uses it as a very in a negative way.
It could be quite judgy, though.
She was a, yeah, we I love her, but I don't think she'd have loved me.
It was a lot.
I am from Telford, which is important. It's great, Telford, but she
Exactly.
wasn't a fan. She wasn't a fan of this kind of area, but she says that in districts like, which we would now call Telford and even Shrewsbury and areas, there was an idea among the labouring people that you, for 40 days, the person who'd passed was still with you in spirit and they stayed close to you. And it was only really family and close friends they would do this to. And in them 40 days, you might still feel like they were there. You might still feel like, be reminded of them, but then they would pass on. And that was linked to the idea that you could grieve for those 40 days, but then after that, you had to kind of have a stiff upper lip because if you grieved, and this is the bit where I think it's very linked to the socioeconomic situation, is that if you grieve too much, it might upset the dead. But in reality, I think that's very linked to the sort of lives these people were living. And because it's exclusively described as being a laboring classes
So you had to
piece
go
of
back to work.
folklore. You had to go on, you had to put food on the table, you had to carry on. That doesn't mean that that person was actually not grieving. They just kept it in and they dealt with it in their own way. And I think for all of the pageantry of the Victorian period, there's also a lot of humanity and personal stories. And,
Agreed.
I had a little look on the British newspaper archives prior to this, because I'm going to be sharing some
We love
little
that website.
we
That's a
do we
shout out to them. They are,
sponsor us.
do you
Don't you don't have to sponsor us.
know,
We
I
love
haven't
you.
sworn on a pod for a while. They're fucking great. They're
They are.
fucking great.
And the amount of individual stories you find about funerals is really powerful. And I am going to be sharing some in the leading up to this episode and afterwards, just to kind of convey the just like the Victorians were have a reputation for being fascinated with death and with murder. Funerals also were important features of society, and you get kind of really big, extravagant funerals reported of generals and commanders in the army and royalty. But you also get insights into everyday people, and I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I think, look, you touched on that thing with the labouring classes, but look at us now. We still, the tradition has it, or whether that will alter because it's taking longer to get buried or cremated and things, but tradition has it that generally you go back to work after the funeral, which is usually about a fortnight or so. And there's that old adage, isn't there? And we do this when you were touching there and so eloquently on how people felt in the past, and they would have grieved their dead just as much as we do. I think we as modernists, not you and I, because we're like 180 years old, but romantics make the mistake of thinking realists don't feel. So because they lived in a very real situation, we think, oh, they accepted it. I don't think that's the case any more than you look at war zones and things, they're accepting death then. I think they are in a situation that has to be navigated tragically, but I don't think one should assume that they were just desensitized,
No.
impervious to that. Just as when, I would argue that you become adjusted rather than, I think there are just certain situations, certain losses that you should always feel sad about, but you accept them and life has to go on the way that it does. And I think that we share that with our ancestors in that way. And I think the idea of being suit and booted at a funeral, going to a wake afterwards, going to a pub, having a drink in your suits, the pubs that I've been to, you can tell instantly if there's been a funeral, probably because there's a whole array of men sitting in dark blue or black suits or things like this. There's a lot of practices that probably wouldn't look out of place 100 years ago. And still phrases, we still say, oh, I don't want to speak ill of the dead or whatever. And sometimes some of the biggest laughs I've heard have been at a wake, because as perverse as that sounds, because, same as the same graveyard, you've got to remember that the deceased is heartbreaking, but also they were people that loved laughter, that loved sex and all the things, it depends on the person, I suppose. When I'm dead, I'll come back and haunt everyone. But I think, I do think there's a celebration of life, but I think we also, just as our ancestors had, they were people that lived, that had personalities, that had, and I think that is often a space for remembering that and for talking about them. And, once you take the religious aspect out of it, but then do you? Because when my dad died, I opened the window. These are things that are just naturally happen. And people do things like pass a hare on the road and think, oh, things are kind of prophetic as a sign or what have you. And chances are it's because you're in hare breeding season or something. It's probably just, complete nonsense. But, the amount of people that say, oh, I saw a robin, And my granny's dad, I think, well, actually, robins are fairly domesticated here because we don't eat small birds on this continent and this island. So, you know, they've got more of a trusting relationship with us. You probably haven't got a village cat there. So, you know, there's more often than not, sadly, there is probably a likely reason. But we have immortalized these things as indications of communication from somebody that we need to know is all right.
Yeah.
I think, look, a lot of the time, I think people know. But I think there is something that we shared with our ancestors, and the whole ceremony of a funeral, whether it be brief, whether it be long, whatever your dogma, doctrine, liturgy, whatever, that need to acknowledge a life, to celebrate a life, to then have that as part of the grieving process in whatever degree, is timeless, I think.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think it's every facet of life. It's not one group over the other. And, you know, every inch of society, every facet of society has the same process. And that's always been the case. And, you know, we've said we're going to revisit funerals. I think it's definitely something we're going to do. And as you'll see, as you come on with us on this journey, when we touch on other kind of eras and other kind of, you know, comparing them to Victorian period and looking at other types of funeral and elements of funeral is that actually it's all the same. It might change in the way it's developed or the way it's conveyed, but it's all that need to let that person know they mattered. And I think that's what's so powerful about these rites of passage in human life. And there's a reason we do them, and it's because it's a very human thing to do. And that's where when you see in the Victorian and before, but in the Victorian times, things like pauper funerals and pauper burials, they were seen as so hard for kind of the working class communities and people who were suffering from poverty, because it almost robbed the people of that right. It robbed the people of that good death. And I think pauper funerals in general, they became almost, as we said in our workhouse episode, they became a figure of folklore in themselves, because that fear of being buried without rank, without kind of the trappings of the memorial and the ritual, was very, very scary to people. And in many cases, the spectre of the pauper funeral was part of the movement for cooperatives, and not the only reason, but certainly one of the kind of motivating reasons for things like cooperatives and mining communities having them, and other farming community and cooperatives were kind of across the agrarian and industrial setting, was the idea that if you chipped a little bit of money in, you could not have that very, very kind of sad end and that lack of ritual and memorial. And I think that in itself, the idea of something like a pauper burial being so prominent of a fear in the Industrial Revolution, that it actually spurs on social change, is fascinating. And I don't, as with everything in folklore and that space between kind of folklore and history, I don't know how true the story actually is. But the Earl of Shaftesbury, who I think his name was, he had obviously titles and things, but I think it was Anthony Cooper or Ashley Cooper, but he was the Earl of Shaftesbury. He was the one that limited child labour in the Mines Act of 1842, and he was known as kind of the poor man's Earl. He actually said that it was seeing a pauper funeral where there was drunken bearers conveying a pauper to his grave was the thing that converted him to a life of reform. So he said seeing that sight, because he was an earl, was the thing that made him dedicate his life to social change. And he's a fascinating man. He had various different kind of roles, but the biggest one is the idea of the Children's Labour Act that limited the age children could go down the pits, and other things, social reform. But it's interesting to think that something like a pauper funeral could actually be the spark of social change through things like cooperatives. And, you know, if this man is if he was telling the truth of the story of his formative experience, could dedicate his life to people who are less fortunate than him. So yeah, I think it's fascinating to think, and that's only a very, very quick skim over the idea of pauper funerals, but they were definitely became folkloric in themselves through that fear of being buried in such a way. And as a result, they spurred on movements to try and change that.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? And I think in contrast, you know, it's always fascinating to me, this just the sort of being buried alive, things like this, these very kind of tangible fears and the mercy of kind of circumstance, of situation, of social welfare, things like this. And, you know, you're looking at things like maybe in a very dark sort of feudal system contrast here, royal funerals, which, you know, until the power of monarchy waned, as it is arguably maybe kind of Georgian era on, it starts to ease off. Queen Victoria had her funeral in daylight hours, which was considered even relatively unusual for royal funerals. They used to be, particularly historically, later into things like this, and you know, but as visibility was required, they became in the daytime, and all these kind of things. It always fascinates me, this sort of stark contrast. You know, one of the continuities, of course, is that we've pretty much always worn black. That seems to be the main thing. But even women, you know, if you look at women, and this is going to come as a staggering surprise to you, women weren't always allowed to be involved. Kelsa Priest, shocking. Yeah, I know.
I'm shocked.
Wronged in some capacity historically. Nay, I shall not believe you. Any more than I shall believe a woman is wrong today. You're like, well, try out seatbelts, mate. Anyone with boobs can't wear a seatbelt. I've only got tiny, you know, but the seatbelts, mate, not designed for breasts in any way. But really, Elizabeth I was a funeral where it was odd, because, you know, absolute queen in more ways than one. She was an absolute, she's a diva. There were women at her funeral and
procession
as well. You know, there were women dropping to their knees crying, you know, because she was a bastion of what is cool to be a woman. But it was considered greatly unusual that there were these women in her procession, you know, and whilst we look at these sort of details in terms of things from an effigies and all these bizarre effigies and some of which survive, which are actually, if you Google them, fairly harrowing.
Yes.
But I sort of love them. And again, that's almost an episode on its own. But, you know, this idea of just like with like suicides, unbaptized children, all these things are just innocence, really. We're buried at the north side of the chapel and buried outside chapel walls in some cases. It's always chapel to me. I come from a Baptist family or church. You know, these things that it's a very complex, convoluted thing.
Yes.
I think is the thing. And you know, what does one look at? Like I say, you can look at customs, you can look at colours, you can look at things. But I think the other thing, of course, with death, as with all things in England to this present day, is still divided by class. I'm not going to go on a red sheep of the family. I'm not going to go on a Decca Mitford rant.
Save that for the Patreon.
Save that for the Patreon. Subscribe and listen to the girl with this voice who's very left wing. But don't call me champagne.
The political ramblings of the Shropshire Witches podcast.
Yeah. Who's the one with a really posh voice that keeps saying really commie stuff?
And who's the really rough one that agrees?
I've got to say, no, because I always say, like, you've got the Peaky Blinder accent and I love it. It's really good. And I'll be like, she's the knowledgeable one.
I don't know about that. I'm like, that's,
you're
no, that was, you're right, Bab.
You're Albert, right, Bab, how are you? I feel like it's more offensive if I do it. I'm just down there like that witch.
Honestly, being from Telford, working anywhere outside of Telford, it's, miss, you sound like a Peaky Blinder. But then that makes me sound more like, because I'm like, no, I don't.
I don't.
Stop fighting. It is bad. I'm sorry to the people of Birmingham, because that was as bad as the accents in.
Oh, I do it with the Dublin accents. Well, I'm like, the boss will be here in a minute. And I think they're like, don't ever do that again. But I've got to say, on TikTok as well, one of the main things, I was like, lovely voice. Some people are really nice. And then other people are like, God, he's so posh, you can't even function. I've had one, someone say, I mean, he's not wrong. I say all the time. I've had, honestly, like, some of the comments on my accent are the best thing I've ever
best
heard.
I ever had was, I sound like I would be working your land.
What, me?
Yeah, I sound me like I would be working your land. Which they're not wrong. I'm sorry, Squire. Don't know if I told you that one.
Not in an arsehole-y way. It's just because I've got to say, I will take the piss out of myself to the cows come home, as Amy will say, like, I'm a caricature of myself. And I honestly, some of the comments, and I've done Instagram videos on this because I've just been crying, like, with so, like, crying laughing with some of the stuff people say. And one of the main occurring ones I get is gap year. That comes up a
Oh,
lot.
yeah.
Gap year. I also get sarcle because I said it's concentric circles and someone put sarcle. And I was reading it and I going,
Oh, that's it.
sarcle? I was like, oh, sarcle. It was so good. So, yeah, I like you'd be working my land. The irony is, I actually work my granny's land.
You know, if there's any jobs going, I am free for 6 weeks. So, you know, the job's a job at the end of the day, isn't
Me emptying the sheep pens for my uncle. It's like, no, don't worry. No, I work our own land.
I can do it myself. I don't need riffraff there.
That was not my projection at all. I was laughing that I'm actually the one who has to work. I'm like, oh yeah, and let me just say, FOC, free of charge. Because that's what it's like, old school family. It's like, sure, could you do that for free? Yeah, of course. Of course.
I'll do
I
it.
mean, you definitely couldn't afford to pay me. No, but I could, but I think it's better you do it for free. It's character building. Oh no, I think that sounds great.
I'm in my 30s. I've got all the character I need.
Yeah, do you think I could get paid? No, I shouldn't think so. Okay, good. Oh, that's made my day. But yeah, that was very funny. Yeah, we do get, like, there's some very, very funny comments. Sometimes people, but the main one, as I say, get you, but I do regularly get people saying different things. Some people have asked me to do ASMR or whatever it is, like saying, I was like, oh, right, that's niche. One guy said, I could, he's a middle-aged man, let me hasten to add, because look, to have the confidence of those guys, as we know, they are the bastion of all that is right. Are you 42 plus and a white middle-aged man? Because I feel like you're informed on everything. But he said that it would be much better if I didn't say and perhaps if I just filled those gaps with silence instead. Yourself?
I'm more than but I just wanted to add some in just to you know.
Yeah, just say, hey, go fuck yourself.
I am too.
Yeah, we all You got a problem with that? Unfollow. I take your feedback, but hey, don't be an asshole. So there we go. Is there anything? I feel like we can't be serious after that, but that has
No, I think we've the thing is, I think we've discussed a heavy topic today.
been.
And I think
I can't stop laughing at. Yeah, sorry. Go. We have discussed a heavy topic. Continue,
and
please, in the serious thread.
I think we've done a really good introduction to some of the things that we will be revisiting
Yeah.
in future episodes because there is so much we can talk about, and there's a whole world of, you know, funeral customs, funeral folklore, funeral kind of ideas that transcend the centuries, but also then kind of are commonalities. So
Yeah.
as we've both said, we will be revisiting this topic. And I hope you have enjoyed it. I've certainly enjoyed
I've loved
this deep dive. And also, thank you for the people that don't think that I work Alex's land. I'd be useless on a farm because
Don't start me again.
I spend a lot of time talking to the animals rather than doing actual work. Not in a Dr. Doolittle way. I wish I could. I mean, very one-sided conversations.
I'm
Yeah,
gonna be
but.
there, like, offering you tears. I go, so what you tell me about the Reformation. And you'd be like, is this broad ever going to go away? Yeah, no, I'd just be going along with the wheelbarrow, which incidentally, especially myself, I used to put the dogs in the wheelbarrow to push them
Oh.
along, and they loved it. And I'd be like, oh, Amy, I see you there. Just tell me, I'm interested in oak tree folklore. Would you indulge me? And you'd be like,
And
come
then you'd see me push
back.
my invisible glasses up and go, actually, I can.
Actually, yeah.
I
I'd be like, she's the knowledgeable one. I forget
love
just as well. We've said this before that I am the basic. Like, I have had an iced coffee and I drive a Fiat 500. Like, I am Amy is the true chatelaine of this
Oh.
podcast. Like, she is the bastion of folkloric knowledge.
I'm partial to a nice coffee too, and I think
Oh, yeah.
we balance each other out. And I'm glad, in a way, we've had this little bit at the end where we're being a bit silly, because I think
I
that is the Shropshire Witches podcast, is that we can look at, and as I hope the listeners will agree, we can look at difficult topics and we can
Yeah.
discuss them, but ultimately
We can laugh and run.
we can laugh as well. And that really links to funerals. Like, I used to be a support worker, and I used to have to take a lot of elderly people to funerals. And I had a wonderful chap who was in his 80s, who he was from Liverpool, and we were in a funeral, and I was trying to keep, sensible, the fact that, I didn't know the person that I was at the funeral, but he did. And he looked over at me in the thickest Liverpool accent, said, "This is full of old bastards in here." And I
Yeah.
went from being upset at the ceremony of the funeral to being in stitches and having to leave. So, the humor is needed, and I think it's a natural thing that when humans are dealing with difficult things to venture onto the human side, the humor side.
Oh,
But
yeah.
no, I think we'll definitely revisit this, and we'll definitely look at it in a little bit more detail at some other eras. So if you've got another period of history that you would be interested in us delving into, if you'd like to hear more Victorian, if you'd like us to kind of look at other cultures, funeral practices and things like that, let us know, because we are always interested in what you have to say. We're
Yeah.
always interested in feedback, even if it is about me working your land.
I was just about to say there's a middle-aged white man somewhere has just gone, right, he's clicked his knuckles and he is typing some shit.
Yeah,
He's
and we're
going,
interested in,
right,
we
girl,
want
I think you should do
we
this. Yeah.
we've got episodes that we have planned. We've got some absolutely wonderful episodes, if we do say so ourselves, coming. But equally, if you'd really like to hear the Shropshire Witches talk about something, we would love to explore that. So let us know if there's any topics. And I hope you're ready for more funerals in the not too distant funeral, not in your lives. I'm not wishing, I am the angel of death, but not in that way. But more discussions
Death.
about funerals, and also some wonderful other topics that do link as well to the Victorian period. We're in our Victorian era, I think,
Oh, and I
Alex.
love it. It's gonna be really hard for us to come out of this because we're all obsessed with Victorian. Say, well, I say all of us, the two of us. We're going to be sort of saying, well, how about this one? We could do three Victorian episodes. Like, three will never be enough. Like, if you're in Victorian Shropshire, London, wherever, that's it. And I think we need Dreamboat John and Amara back. We need all the kind of like the Victorian Edwardian, that is music to my ears. Amy is quite right. If you've got anything you think we should be talking about, or you find interesting, let us know. Any men that want to comment on the umming and things like that, let me do my job, not your knob. And I think thank you as always. You've indulged us and supported us from the start, and you're still with us. So we love you. Thank you. And more death, decay, and a bit of feminist history ASAP, I'd say.
Very much so. All the good stuff.
All the good stuff. Thank you so much, guys. Good
Thank
night and
you.
take care. All right.
Bye.
Good night. Good night.